Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 60 for July 27th, 2010. I'm your host, Dominic Rabier, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First, the spat between WordPress and the thesis theme. Second, Massachusetts considering a right to repair law. And finally, Facebook versus power.com. We'll dive right into our first story, WordPress and thesis.
So recently there was a bit of a spat between WordPress, the common blogging platform, and thesis, which is a program used to create customized themes for said blogs. So this was a program that cost, I believe, $87 a copy and was used to enhance WordPress blogs so that they looked better and looked nicer. And this developed into a bit of a spat because WordPress uses the GPL, the new public license, for all of their stuff. So it's all open source and available for you to use and modify. The one key requirement, though, is that any program that uses WordPress must also contain the GPL, which the people behind Thesis did not agree with. Thesis, which, as I mentioned, is a premium template system, meaning that it costs money, did not want to be under the GPL because they had a decent business platform that they were using, and it therefore, if they released it under the GPL, releasing all of the source code, then they would no longer be allowed to, or they would not be as easily able to sell their platform. Let me just start by saying, did I hit the points of the GPL correctly, lawyer friends?
Yes. What's interesting about this story, to dive in a little, is did you have more in the intro, or did you want to just dive into how it's sort of resolved?
We can dive into it more first, and then we'll get to the resolution at the end.
Okay, go ahead then.
And so recently on Mixergy, there was a public discussion of this by Chris Pearson, the creator of the thesis theme, and Matt Mullenweg, who was one of the co-founders of WordPress. And they went into debating whether or not thesis should be under the GPL. And there was a lot of interesting arguments in there. And I think a lot of it boiled down to the fact that Chris Pearson viewed the thesis theme and the program used for generating those as a sort of derivative work from WordPress. And can one of you guys sort of dive into what sort of argument he was taking there?
Right. So when we typically think of derivative works, you would think of something like a cover song or a sequel to a movie or a movie that was based on a book. So the Harry Potter movies are derivative works of the Harry Potter books because the Harry Potter book is the original, and then you keep all of the same plot and character elements in the movie when transferring it over. So J.K. Rowling, who wrote the book, if she owns the copyright in the book, would also own the copyright in the movie, assuming, depending on licensing. What's interesting is when you apply this to something like software code. So in this case, really, there were some lines that were in thesis that were copied directly from WordPress. But even if you ignore that, the way thesis worked, it called the GPL'd WordPress functions, and as a result of calling those functions and integrating the GPL code into its own code, it itself was considered a derivative work under the GPL, a derivative work of WordPress, and therefore would also have to be licensed under the GPL if the person who made it wanted to distribute it, which he clearly did because he did distribute it.
Right, but then the argument would go that everything is essentially commingling in memory with other programs, so is Firefox a derivative work of Microsoft Windows because it calls a bunch of Microsoft Windows API calls calls the operating system, in some senses, what the thesis guys are arguing is that no, clearly Mozilla is not, or sorry, Firefox is not a derivative work of Windows. It is a separate entity despite calling those API calls.
So I think you've kind of hit at some of the big issues here, Mr. Liu. And to me, the big question is whether or not you just have to disclose the source code of the function calls that you're actually using, or whether that's actually going to require you to disclose the entire source code to the whole program that you're creating there. And I think that this is a little bit ambiguous, at least on the face of the license language itself. And this is something that a lot of people point to as one of the large problems with GPL code that's sort of rummaging around out on the internet that people have access to. And often developers, while they're creating proprietary software, will sometimes reference, just for the sake of seeing what the best way to do something is. They'll look into some stuff that is under the GPL, and occasionally they will even incorporate portions of GPL code into their own proprietary software. But people say that if you're going to read it to the extent that if you include any like function call of GPL code into your proprietary software, it's going to require you to disclose your entire source code. A lot of people are just going to completely try to stay away from it and not use it at all. And some people point to the fact that there's only there's a finite number of ways that you can do something while you're writing code. And I mean, there's some people out there who will probably tell you that there are an infinite number of ways to do it, which might also be true. But from the perspective of somebody who develops software, which I am not, people seem to think that there's only a few ways to do certain things, and you get pretty close to doing them sometimes in the way that software that's been licensed under the GPL is already written. And because of that, you might run into some trouble when you try to write stuff yourself, or if you're using certain types of or certain portions of code that's already been written under the GPL, you might run into problems if you write stuff that's a little too close to it. So that's one of the bigger arguments here. I don't know that I can immediately resolve that, but I can certainly empathize a little bit with the frustrations of the creator for thesis. Dominic or Ben, do you guys have any more specific thoughts on the license itself and how that might play into these different interpretations?
I think it's pretty clear that the bargain that you enter when you develop for something that uses GPL code, or you develop something with GPL code, is that by using that code, you end up infecting, if we want to use a bad word, infecting your own code with the GPL license, or by choosing the option of using GPL code as part of your code base, or referencing GPL functions that you agree that your product will also be licensed under the GPL. Linux developers have gone through hoops to either let's say Nvidia makes drivers for one of their graphics card. They'll distribute the driver as a binary, so that so they don't reference GPL code, and they distribute it as a binary so that it can't be easily broken back down into code and modified. At this point in the game, it seems a little late to be arguing that calling GPL, that if you have a program that makes calls to GPL software, that it's your program doesn't then fall under the GPL as a derivative work, or as otherwise enveloped under the GPL. I agree that if we're taking a broader look at copyright law in general, there's a decent argument that just making a call to a function isn't enough. But I think in the realm of the GPL, that argument, the time for that argument has passed.
So I guess what you're saying is you agree with the sentiments of the WordPress folks, that this effectively puts the creator of Thesis under the GPL and the requirements therein.
As far, yes, I'll just say yes.
I think there was also an interesting argument here about whether, this is going back to the sort of definition of whether it was derivative before. In the conversation we mentioned before, Chris Pearson talks about this one article that was written. on the blog Perpetual Beta that discusses the case of Galoob versus Nintendo, which is talks about Nintendo and competing with Galoob's product of Game Genie, which essentially used the Nintendo system and used the Nintendo games, but modified them slightly. And so, clearly it was integrating with the code involved in both of those and was modifying it slightly, but was not useful independently of itself. And therefore, I think the argument was that the Game Genie is not a derivative work of a Nintendo game, and similarly, that WordPress themes, despite calling WordPress API calls, was not independent from WordPress itself, and therefore not a derivative work. Do you guys think that holds up?
Game Genie is a very different beast. From what I understand, what Game Genie did was essentially reach into the memory of the Nintendo device. Well, so it was a cartridge that would go in between, it would go into the Nintendo, and then you would plug your regular cartridge into the Game Genie, and it would intercept and modify specific snippets of code. So if for Mario Brothers, for instance, I remember that you could punch in a code into Game Genie, and then what it would do is it would modify your the number of lives you have by, intercepting or just modifying that bit of code in memory so that you'd automatically have 99 lives and you'd have that perpetually. Yeah, that's very different from integrating deeply into a program with multiple calls and really integrating with it on a level that Thesis does with WordPress.
Actually, what Game Genie does is similar to that, but I don't believe it actually modifies code. It just changes numbers that are returned from the cartridge. So if I am playing Mario Brothers, the console or the code of the game will say, okay, retrieve this number from the game cartridge to tell me how many lives to start with. And the Game Genie will intercept that call and say, the answer was 99, not 5. Just fun technical point.
Either way, I don't think it changes the final analysis that Thesis it does not. Thesis is so deeply integrated with WordPress that Thesis is deeply integrated with WordPress. Game Genie is less deeply integrated with the Nintendo device or the individual games.
Yeah, and I think ultimately a lot of this came down to not what the creators of Thesis actually thought of the GPL, but just sort of disagreements with the philosophy that, using this mandates that you use the GPL as well. Because there was one comment in there that was saying that forcing anybody who makes a derivative work to use the GPL is like declaring that our children should pay our debt, and, sort of the deficit spending argument. And I really just ultimately, it seems to come down to the fact of if you want to play in this sandbox, you have to play by the sandbox's rules if you agree to the license. So, this case was actually resolved in the last week as well, in that the makers of Thesis relented and decided to use the GPL, or at least use a quote split GPL. So, as it turns out, they are going to use the GPL for the that integrate with WordPress, and then the other half of it, the CSS and JavaScript codes that do not call WordPress will not be GPL. So that'll remain proprietary, and I think allow them to still charge for the code and still make a profit. Any final thoughts on this?
The split thing is pretty interesting. Like you said, basically they're splitting off the CSS and JavaScript. So I'm not sure whether that is fine in the sense that it's still, in some sense, a derivative work, because without WordPress, the CSS and JavaScript wouldn't have anywhere to live, if that makes sense.
it's kind of interesting to think about what a court might do if this ever came to litigation and, you know, a judge was forced to decide on the correct interpretation of the GPL. But, you know, the more that I listen to both Ben and Dominic's thoughts, it seems that, you know, there's a pretty strong argument that this probably puts the thesis software under, at least portions of it, under the GPL. And if there isn't a correct way to separate those two things, then he would probably have to open the entire thing up.
We can probably move on to our next story, which is the Massachusetts right to repair law.
Right. So essentially, the heart of this is that if you were to bring some certain late model newer cars into a repair shop, like a mom and pop repair shop, and say there's something wrong with my car, the check engine light is on, there's a good chance that they will throw up their hands and say, I'm sorry, we can't do anything about it. The only place where we can figure out, the only place where, you know, you can bring your car to figure out what's actually wrong with it is if you bring it to a dealership, because they're the only people who have the software that will tell you, you know, it's called a code, what code the engine has pulled, what sensor has gone wrong, or what the computer in the car thinks is wrong with the car. The problem with this is that it's massively unfair to little mom and pop shops, and they can't really do anything about it, because since there's software involved, and presumably some sort of encryption involved in the software, specifically with relation to how the computer in the car speaks with the software that pulls out these codes, they can't. Mom and pop stores can't, you know, make their own software that would speak with the car and get the codes out of the car. And that this is because of copyright and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act specifically, which prohibits circumventing any effective encryption. Now, every year since pretty much the DMCA came out, there has been a bill in Congress that's a right to repair law that would create an exception in the DMCA. It would do one of two things. It would either create an exception in the DMCA for repairing cars, or it would create a mandatory license that car manufacturers would have to license software to mom-and-pop shops so that they could buy the software and effectively repair these cars. Incidentally, there is a right to repair for computer software. So there was a case a while back where somebody brought their computer into a repair shop. The people in the repair shop did not have a license to run whatever operating system the computer was running. They booted up the computer, ran the software, fixed it, and gave the computer back, and the company that made the software sued the computer repair shop because the computer repair shop didn't have a right to run the software, but they ran the software anyway. And shortly thereafter, Congress amended the Copyright Act to say that, you know, this is a permissible use. We're not looking to prosecute people for fixing computers. This should be something that people have the right to do. And now people are looking for a similar law with regard to cars. The federal law, the bill that has been introduced year after year in Congress, has failed repeatedly. And now Massachusetts has passed the law in the Senate, but the same law is still pending in the House of Representatives in Massachusetts. And what this law would say is essentially what I was saying earlier, that car manufacturers would have to provide copies of this software to mom and pop car repair shops. Whew. Okay, anybody have initial thoughts before we dive into what some of the legal issues here are? Let's start with you, Dominic.
It seems like a good idea. I mean, otherwise, how in the world are they going to compete? Like, it kind of sucks for them because they're like, hi, yeah, we can't legally run the software that we need to fix your car, so we can't help you. You have to go to the dealership. We're sorry. Like, that's a pretty terrible situation for a business to be in.
Right. Anybody else have thoughts before we really crack down into the nitty-gritty?
I think it goes without saying that this makes Honda and WordPress very different companies.
Yeah, I actually don't know if Honda is one of the companies that has this software, or has effective encryption on that software. But, I mean, I guess that's a discussion for a different day. when
the
I first
example
read
in
this.
The example in the story is a Honda place, so that's just where I got that.
Oh, okay. In that case, maybe they do. Oh, yeah, Honda dealership, because those are the only places. Okay, it's interesting. When I've brought my car into places, they seem to be fine with it, but we'll see what happens. I've never had the check engine light come on in my Honda, but I digress. So my first question, and the first thing that popped into my head when I saw this was, would this law be preempted by federal copyright law? Because right now, if you bring a copyright suit, you have to bring it in federal court. If any state tries to enact something similar to copyright, it's all preempted by federal law. The federal government has essentially a monopoly on copyright law. And this strikes me as a state trying to make a mandatory copyright license. This strikes me as something that would be preempted by federal law. And I should note that every year when the right to repair bill has been introduced in the federal in Congress, in the federal system, it's been kind of batted down and hampered by car industries who say that, you know, they've got a right to effective encryption and they've got a right to, you know, license their software to whom they choose. And, you know, the same companies have been fighting this in state legislatures, and I'm sure we'll fight this later in state court if this law actually gets passed. So, going back to the question, does anyone see a preemption problem with this other than me?
It's possible, but, you know, that is a section of the Copyright Act that is very infrequently discussed in court decisions these days, and the provision basically states, and this is Section 301 of the Copyright Act, that all legal or equitable rights that are equivalent to any of the exclusive rights within the general scope of copyright are governed exclusively by this title. And that sort of sets forth the basic provision, which you can have some sort of argument around a preemption kind of thing, basically that no state could enact anything that has to do with the rights that deal with, that are exclusively governed by the Copyright Act. You know, we're talking about basically something along the lines of like a compulsory license or some other exception under what would otherwise fall under the Copyright Act. So it's kind of possible that a court could come to the conclusion that yes, this does in fact violate that Section 301 provision in the Copyright Act, and therefore it is preempted by federal law. But you know, it's a little unclear just because of the way that courts treat that position, and just they tend to resolve questions that kind of deal with the Section 301 issues on other grounds if they can, just because they like avoiding the constitutional questions.
I mean, this is technically statutory, not constitutional, but I agree that courts tend to avoid preemption questions because they're very difficult to figure out. I don't know if I adequately explained preemption, but they're... In the federal system that we have, you've got the federal government, and there are some things over which the federal government has absolute control, and any state interference with that is preempted, is forbidden by what the federal government has enacted. And there are other places where there's some sort of power sharing, like electronic health records. The federal government has the ability to set like a floor for, you know, this is the minimum level of protection states need to enact on electronic health records. But states can then come in and enact their own regulations that are more protective or, you know, outline specifically how hospitals or physicians in that area have to address this. Copyright, on the other hand, is an issue where the federal government has total control. There have been cases where states, I think Florida at one point, enacted a law that would give essentially copyright protection to makers of boats to protect the design of the boat hulls, because boat hulls are not protectable by copyright, because there's some function that goes into the hull. You know, the way a hull is designed helps, you know, cuts cost, or it makes the boat go faster through water, or, you know, reduces drag or friction. And that law was struck down because basically what the law did was create a copyright for boat hulls, and the federal government has exclusive jurisdiction on that. Dominic, any thoughts on, you know, assuming that the court doesn't avoid the preemption question, do you have any thoughts on whether or not it would be successful, whether or not the preemption argument would be successful here?
Give me a mini summary of what you understand as the preemption argument in this case, that the copyright
Right, that the Copyright Act says that the federal government is the only people who can make laws with relation to copyright.
Okay.
And what
I
this
see
law
what you're
does
saying.
is it creates a new compulsory license. So there are already compulsory licenses in the copyright. There's the compulsory license that
So
governs
how did the
cover
Florida
covers.
boat hole thing do? Like, did they went to Congress, right? Because Florida itself couldn't do that because of preemption.
No, Florida passed a law that was struck down by the court because
Right.
the law was preempted by federal copyright law.
And then Congress came back and said,
No, I don't think Congress has come back and filled that gap. At least
they have,
I've.
though, as far as I
Yeah,
understood.
I
Or
thought
maybe
they
I'm
had
thinking
too.
Really?
of. Yeah.
Let me see if I could find it for you. I mean, this is totally off point, but the
Copyright
real
law of the
question
United
here.
States, Chapter 13, exceptions, the whole. Yeah, the Vessel Hull Design Protection Act in 1998.
Okay,
So to
so
answer your
after
original
that,
question, basically would look like. Go ahead, Dave.
I'm sorry, this is a very small point. It was actually passed as part of the DMCA, I believe.
Because buttholes are both deli are all of these things, digital and millennium and copyrightable now. Yeah,
Buttholes for the new millennium.
it was a, like when it's a legislative quirk that, at times when you're amending certain statutes that you have additional portions of the act which are going to be updated that don't necessarily pertain to the title of the amending bill that's getting enacted. The boat holes were obviously one part of that.
Gotcha. Okay, so back to the preemption argument, Dominic.
To answer your
Any thoughts
question,
on
yes, I think it will probably get preempted, but Massachusetts should pass the law anyway. It'll get struck down, and then Congress will wake up and be like, hey, basically a repetition of the boat hole scenario.
Yeah, con hopefully this will say to Congress it's actually time to do something about this
Right,
because
because I don't think it'll be
it's.
effective to lobby Congress beforehand, because Congress will be like, this is what's going on election year. But if you see they're like, hey, we passed this law, and then the court struck us down because we can't do this, it's actually your job. Well, then Congress will be like, oh, okay.
I mean, the only other thing that someone could do is a company could come in and try to make software that did this. And specifically try to do that in whatever circuit the Lexmark case was decided in. So, very briefly, the Lexmark case said that Lexmark printer manufacturer used to have little chips inside their ink cartridges that would prevent any non-Lexmark chip, any non-Lexmark cartridge from working in the computer. They put, sorry, working in the printer. They put a tiny bit of essentially crappy encryption in the chip so that reverse engineering the chip would violate the DMCA. And a court basically said that because what you're doing, operability with the printer is entirely functional, we're going to say that you can't use the DMCA to protect that. It would be interesting if somebody tried that with this, but my guess is it would be far too dangerous as far as potential liability and litigation cost for somebody to actually try that. If there aren't any thoughts, I guess we can transition into the last story.
Okay then. Well, our last
Oh, wait, I had
story
one thing.
is about.
Sorry.
Please go right ahead.
Or just a quick question. Is the reason why the U.S. federal government controls the copyright and all the laws pertaining to that because basically if Massachusetts passed this law, then they would have to, Honda per se, would have to publish, the software in Massachusetts and then other states could use it, or is that misunderstood?
Well, oh, you're raising a very good and fundamental question, and maybe we should have addressed it. So first of all, everything that Congress does on the federal level needs to be basically permissible under the U.S. Constitution, and as part of that, we have something that we call the Intellectual Property Clause, which is in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, if memory serves, and that's the sort of one of the statutes that allow, or one of the portions of the Constitution that allows Congress to create the intellectual property laws. And there's some argument that just based on that reading alone, it was meant to be within the exclusive purview of Congress to create the IP laws. But notwithstanding that, they also, after enacting the Copyright Act and under the latest amendments and the versions from 1976, they've included the Section 301 language, which basically it states that they don't want the states to create rights that are equivalent to the copyright. To any of the rights that are available under the copyright law. And that's where you have this idea of preemption that comes up. So it's both a kind of a constitutional argument as well as a statutory argument, because we're talking about federal law, which is the supreme law of the land under the Supremacy Clause, and that's been time and time again tested in some of the very early Supreme Court decisions which established that. So in the hierarchy of the way that the U.S. legal systems work, first comes the federal law, then comes the laws that each of the individual states has enacted. So there's a bunch of different reasons why it's a good idea just to have the federal government working on issues that revolve around patent and copyright, and in some cases trademark issues. But for the most part, we're talking about federal issues, and these are all sort of have a basis in the Constitution. Does anyone else have anything to add to that?
No, not really. I mean, just because the power is granted constitutionally, I think you mentioned this, though, just because it's a constitutional power doesn't mean that the federal government has exclusive jurisdiction, but in this case, the statute that says we have exclusive jurisdiction does mean that they have exclusive jurisdiction.
Right, and I guess just as a final very quick point, this is like a quirky section just because of the way that it's worded. It talks about states creating rights that are equivalent to the rights that are granted in the Copyright Act, and just as a, just to pan out my thinking as a lawyer here, I don't know that that's necessarily what's happening, because you're talking about some sort of exclusion which allows people that would otherwise be infringing under the DMCA to sort of skirt around that. Now, there's, I suppose, additional arguments that you could make that because things like fair use are codified within the Copyright Act, you're essentially talking about rights which are also granted under the Copyright Act. If, something is a fair use, then maybe you could consider it a right under the Copyright Act, or something else that eschews somebody from the liability that you might otherwise get as infringing. So I think that, it's a very technical argument. It's probably one that some of the parties might even argue if this ever came to litigation along the if in case that this law was considered to be preempted or not. So we'll see, I suppose. Anyone else have any final thoughts before we move on to the last story?
Take it away.
I'm set.
So this last story involves Facebook and a company called Power.com. It's actually run under the domain Power.com, and it's run by, I think, Power Ventures. And you might remember them because we discussed them a few weeks back in relation to the same lawsuit which is going on. And what Power.com does is it has a website that allows users to sort of aggregate their data on Facebook and a number of other social networking websites, Twitter, MySpace, LinkedIn, to name a few. And what occurs is that the user goes to power.com, they sign in and also provide their credentials to whatever social networking website they also have accounts at, and then the software that's behind power.com then goes in and sort of aggregates their data all across their different social networking account profiles that they have set up. And Facebook was not very happy about this. And if you do recall us talking about this, they sued Power.com and Power Ventures, who was running Power.com, for violations of the DMCA, copyright infringement, basically, for violating the CAN-SPAM Act under some of the anti-spam laws that we have, as well as there were trademark violations alleged in the complaint, too. And interestingly, violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is basically the federal law which prohibits unauthorized access to computer systems. And there was one additional quirk to the complaint, which in addition to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act also alleged a claim under Section 502 of the California Penal Code, which is sort of the equivalent to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in California. And it basically prohibits unauthorized access to computer systems. So this drew the attention of some of the big advocacy groups out there, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and the EFF filed an amicus brief, which eventually became a very influencing document to the court when it issued its opinion on whether or not the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and Section 502 of the California Penal Code could be considered violated here. And what the argument basically was that was panning out between the parties was that Facebook's terms of service does not permit people without authorization to access their website. And the argument was that users did not have the right to authorize Power.com to go in and start scraping data out of their account. And that sort of became the basis for a number of things, not just the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claims and the Section 502 claims, but also some of the copyright claims. And what Facebook was sort of saying there is that the terms of service basically serves to tell you what you can and what you cannot do on our website. And once you start violating those things, we can go after you under some of these provisions under the law, which prohibit unauthorized access and unauthorized copying and so forth. And the EFF really does not like this because they think that under no circumstances should you have once you go outside the terms of service, should you have some sort of violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, especially one that's criminal. And they sort of set forth a huge argument in this amicus brief that they filed. Now, here's what's interesting, though, about this case. And the court, I think, eventually dismissed some portions of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claims. But more importantly, they decided that the California Section 502 claims could continue to go forward. And there were some arguments about what is it actually. And remember, this is the penal code, so we are talking about there is something. This is a civil claim based under the penal code, I believe, here. And Section 502C says that anyone who commits any of the following acts is guilty of a public offense. And under C1, it says that knowingly accesses without permission, alters, damages, deletes, destroys, or otherwise uses any data, computer, computer system, or computer network in order to either A, devise or execute any scheme or artifact to defraud, deceive, or extort, or B, wrongfully control or obtain money, property, or data. So the big issue here was whether or not the terms of service was actually the right way to sort of delineate a person's rights as they access or enter a computer network. And also there was a bit of issue to what otherwise uses also means. But in short, the court accepted the argument that the terms of service could serve to sort of delineate those rights, and that without permission, if you're violating the terms of service agreement, then it qualifies under, it satisfies the standard without permission. And so therefore you could have civil actions based on this statute and potentially criminal actions based on this statute. So, what do you guys think about this case? Is this something that we want to see go on with terms of service agreements and whether or not you could be prosecuted criminally under them?
The Lori Drew case, it was just a district court that ended up deciding that violation of terms of service isn't sufficient for a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, but I don't believe the government appealed that case, and I think it's generally taken now to be true that a mere violation of terms of service does not rise to either a criminal or a civil violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So I don't think people should bother pursuing this anymore. I don't think, in general, people believe that that's a proper use of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act or a useful way to spend anyone's time, but I'm just kind of sick of these claims, so my view may be skewed.
I will actually disagree with you just a tiny bit here, and I think that there's something to be said that, you know, if you consider a web server that you're running, let's say that you're a business or something like that, you're running a web server, you put up a terms of service agreement, and that basically tells any users which come on the site, which if they're going to use the services that you're offering on the website, you have to agree to the following terms. And if you stay in there, that, you know, we're granting you right to access certain parts of the site but not others. We don't want you giving access to the underlying services to any other entities, so you basically can't sub-license out your rights to somebody else. Those things should, in some cases at least, be able to serve as the document that establishes what you can and cannot access, I think. Because there's really no other way to do it. The analogy draws that if you have an apartment and you invite a bunch of people over and you have because you're the possessor or the owner of the apartment, you do have the right to tell people, it's okay, why don't you come in and hang out in the living room, but please don't go in the bedroom or the bathroom or the kitchen or wherever. You know, you're telling them that those areas are off access, and if you're going to go into one of them, I can go after you for violating or for trespassing on my property. So that's the analogy I draw, at least. And maybe,
but there are provisions for trespass to chattels. It's a little different from the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. You wouldn't just be able to sue someone for using part of a software service that you provide without permission, but that is otherwise freely accessible. For trespass to chattels, you'd have to be able to prove that, you know, the amount of traffic that you drove there caused some sort of blockage or actually caused damage or, you know, financial hardship on the servers. So there is a remedy there that's between opening up the terms of service violations to criminal and civil prosecution and to just allowing people to traipse all over your hardware.
Dominic?
What question, or just in general?
Do you agree with some of the conclusions that the court reached here, that, you know, you can have a violation of a terms of service agreement qualify as a violation of either the Penal Code or the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in terms of access rights?
I think I have to, because I don't see how else you would enforce the terms of service in terms of access rights.
Well, you could pursue it under a breach of contract claim, in theory at least.
In theory is the key part of that sentence.
Right, right. You know, I don't know. I mean, there isn't... We're talking about private areas of the Internet, and these services are being provided by private entities, by businesses, by maybe private individuals, and just the same as you can invite somebody onto your property and or not want them on their property and tell them they're not allowed to be on your property. I mean, I do think that there should be a way to do that on the Internet.
I will say, though, just the phrase private parts of the Internet seems a little odd. Just because most people assume that if it's out there on the Internet, it's free to use. But that's not a legal standpoint. That's just a culture thing.
So probably worth noting this case also is that at least one or two points in the while the dispute was going on between Power.com and Facebook, Facebook actually employed some sort of IP blocking measures where they blocked ranges of Power.com servers from accessing the site. And at another point, the folks over at Power.com became aware of this and then also implemented some measures to circumvent those blocking provisions that they had set up at Facebook and was able to regain access then to the Facebook site. Does that change your mind at all, Ben?
Nah, not really. I'm staunch on this, that it's the CFAA is not the way to go.
And why not?
Because it's, I don't know, it seems like the type of thing that should be reserved for, and that I think at least socially we have said that this is reserved for, you know, hacking into somebody's computer, not for not agreeing or going beyond what terms of service allow, even if that's technically exceeding authorized access. Because the authorized access there isn't password authorized access, it's what somebody has said in a document that you can do.
Now, I do agree with some of the sentiments of the EFF that they think that if you're going to have criminal actions that are the result of somebody violating a terms of service agreement, that's something that should not stand under the law. And I do kind of agree with that, because you are basically then giving companies or just owners of websites under their terms of service agreement the right to sort of enact pr- private criminal laws, and you know, if anybody, they could almost come up with some really ridiculous stuff in a terms of service agreement, as long as it's still within contract law. And as the moment someone goes outside of that, you know, they could be you know, bothering the local police department to go and arrest somebody because they're doing something outside the terms of service agreement, and they're therefore should be put in jail. I mean, I do think that that's a little silly, and you know, you can sort of bring that argument ad nauseum to some of the odder examples of why we shouldn't do that. But in terms of the civil rights and being able to sue somebody and being able to take them to court and asking them to stop accessing your servers, you know, I can't think of a better way to do this than something like this act, whether we're talking about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act or state-enacted laws that maybe aren't in the penal codes of the states like this California one, but do sort of speak to other private rights where you can recover stuff under the law if somebody is violating, you know, what you are putting out to be access rights to their servers.
So block their IP address. Don't take somebody into court.
They did. And then they continued to get around that, probably by setting up proxies or just something else, renting out server space from some other location in the country or outside of the country. I mean, if you think about it, you know, that could go on forever and ever and ever. I mean, these guys, as long as a party is willing to continue to try to sidestep whatever technical measures you've taken to try to protect your servers, you know, you might be fighting them forever to, you know, try to figure out what range of IP addresses their servers are at now so you can block it and prevent them from accessing it.
Would you legislate differently, Ben, so that it didn't fall into the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and it was a separate offense to access parts of websites in different ways, you know, like define it in some terms of service or... Yeah, in terms of services, or would you just rather it not be legislated or not be prosecuted at all?
I would say either lock that part of the website down somehow so that, you know, so that a spider or whatever the software is technically called can't get to it, or have it open and deal with it. Or result to IP blocking or other methods to throw off the software that does it. Essentially, make an API or deal with people not having access to your API or not having the access that they want to the API and trying to get around it.
It seems vaguely reminiscent of the movie listings that we talked about way long ago in a different podcast, but I don't remember how that one resolved.
Oh, it's actually very close to it, and same kind of issues, as a matter of fact. And if I remember correctly, I think the result in that case was that a violation of the terms of service is not criminal for purposes of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I don't know if that how that played out to this California penal section here, because that was a case that was also in California. But again, we're talking about the distinction between criminal stuff and civil stuff. I mean, criminal stuff you get arrested for, and if convicted, you might serve some jail time or pay criminal fines. Civil stuff is, you know, when you sue somebody else, you take them to court, and you try to get some sort of remedy out of them under the law, whether that might be like an injunction to get somebody to stop doing something, or damages if you can get them under the law, and, you know, which might include in some cases attorney's fees or compensatory damages for damages caused to whatever it is that you're suing under, or punitive damages, which is the big stuff that goes beyond just what the damage was that was caused. Dominic, any final thoughts?
All set.
Okay, well, thank you for listening again to the Technically Legal Podcast. Signing off, I was David O'Brien, and with me...
Dominic Rabier.
Ben Snickoff.
And David Liu.
As usual, you can send us comments and story suggestions to podcast@technicallylegal.org. You can follow us at Twitter @TechLegal, and please be sure to visit our blog at technicallylegal.org. See you again next week.
Bonus points to whoever uses the word Zerg in the podcast.